Welcome to Discovery 1, Revision Lecture 3. Now, does anybody have any questions, queries, things they want me to go over that they would like me to go over before I come up with a couple of small things that I want to cover in greater detail?
Carrie, this is Armando. Another student and I were talking earlier, and what would be the best way to do the peer-to-peer network?
With two computers and a crossover cable.
Okay.
Look, I mean, seriously, guys, you guys are not in a developing country. There are developing countries where we really do have trouble getting two computers and a crossover cable into the one location. But we feel that if perhaps you could get a friend to bring their computer over, or a friend to bring their laptop over, or you've got a laptop and a desktop that have got... yeah, network connectivity.
Sounds good.
When I did it, I just used two netbooks.
Not everybody has two netbooks, Scott, but yeah, that's a good way of doing it.
Sure.
Armando, do you think you're going to have trouble pulling those resources into one place? Is there anybody that could help you get those resources into one place? Do you perhaps have a laptop and a desktop or similar?
I do have that. It's just a crossover cable, but I'm sure I can scrounge one up somewhere.
Okay, we'll see how you go. Obviously, you also have crimping tools, so worst case scenario, you could build one. It wouldn't be a lot of fun, but you could do it, and it would probably be quite educational.
No, thank you. I don't want to remember. I actually put it away somewhere in storage. I don't want to remember the salesman.
Okay. All right. So, as I was saying, if you can possibly do the peer-to-peer network, and this goes for everybody and anybody listening to the recording, two computers and a crossover cable. If you do not have two computers and a crossover cable, but you do have one computer with lots of RAM and lots of processor, you can install VMware Player, boot up two virtual machines, and simulate connection and disconnection of the network cable.
Fair enough.
Okay. Now... any other questions from anybody? Any things that people are finding a bit murky? Any things that people are finding a bit confusing? Any things that people want me to go over again? We're all happy with the OSI reference model being physical data link network session, transport, presentation session, and application. All that sort of stuff. Everybody happy with all that?
What's the saying for that again?
Please do not throw sausage pizza away. Or all people seem to need data processing. Sorry, Paul.
I was gonna. You stole the words out my mouth. I was gonna tell him.
Yeah, I realised that. As soon as you'd sort of started to say the p, I went I could either let go of the button or I could finish my sentence. And I haven't had my second coffee today, so I just finished. Which is fine. Yeah, it's all good. So please do not throw sausage pizza away. Or all people seem to need data processing. There are other ones. There's another one that Glenn came up with, which was Australia Post sucks, they never deliver parcels. So it just depends which one you like the best.
I have a problem here occasionally with it.
Sorry?
I have a problem with the Postal Service here occasionally with that kind of thing.
Don't we all? Ours is bizarre. If you miss your parcel in Australia, they don't re-deliver. They drop a card in your letterbox, and then you have to go down to the mail exchange centre and pick up your parcel. Okay. Now, unfortunately, this has got nothing to do with Discovery 1, so that's about as far as I'm going to go with that, but it is rather tedious.
I can imagine.
Okie dokie. Now, all right. Now, we've had some questions about Lab 8.4.2. And what we've got is, can anybody tell me, because I know a lot of people don't have access to the routers and stuff, not everybody has a Linksys WRT310N or a WRT300N, and even if you do have a Linksys WRT300NXN, it's not going to be the easiest lab to do, but you can do it. Can anybody tell me, what is a demilitarized zone?
Would it be the place where two routers intersect, or where they don't collide, maybe.
Nice try, but no, not quite.
It's usually a neutral zone.
Kind of where no traffic passes through in that zone.
Okay, just hang on, guys. I've got to turn you guys up. I'll be one moment. Okay, anybody watch Star Trek? Anybody heard of the neutral zone? You know, Jean-Luc Picard and his ship with all the phasers and stuff, and the Romulans, and they're going to take a mission into the neutral zone. Okay, anybody with me on this one?
Absolutely.
Yes. Absolutely, yes.
Oh, good, good. I'm glad to see that we're not sadly underrepresented in Geek and Nerd Day, which is the 25th of May, celebrating the release of the first Star Wars movie, A New Hope, in 1977. Okay. The Neutral Zone is a zone between the Romulan Empire and the Federation, and it is an area where you are not supposed to have any military activity, and it is meant to be a buffer zone that separates the separates the two warring peoples. So, for example, the bad Romulans and the good Federation, okay? Now, you have these things. This is also known as a demilitarized zone, and in fact they also refer to it as the demilitarized zone because you're not supposed to have any military activity in there, or that's sort of the zone where if you cross into these zones, people start asking big questions, okay? Now, a demilitarized zone as far as a computer is concerned, we all understand the concept that a firewall protects your internal corporate network or your internal home network from the big bad internet, and the firewall is the device that protects your internal network. Everybody cool with that? All right. Now, what a demilitarized zone is it is the ability to put. That's a general term, but now I'll cover how it is generally configured on home routers, but I'll cover the general thing first. A demilitarized zone is generally a zone that sits between your protected network and the internet, and you put servers in the demilitarized zone or various things into the demilitarized zone so that they can be accessed from the internet without providing open access to the internal network. Okay, now everyone following me so far?
Yes, I am.
Like for example, if you was running a web server, would that be something you would put in the DMZ, demilitarized zone?
Certainly is, and in fact, if you look at some of the firewall distributions, they actually have. There is actually a firewall distribution called Zero Shell, sorry guys, just had to give somebody a password and I didn't want that going onto the recording. Lost my train of thought now. Web server in the demilitarized zone, I can't remember.
Zero Shell.
Zero Shell. Thank you, Rich. There we go. And no, you can't get an extra 5 marks on your lab, but yeah. Zero Shell, www.zeroshell.net/eng, is a Linux-based firewall distribution, and the only reason I mention it is A, because it's really cool, and B, because it throws up a serial console so that blind people can access it when it first comes up and then put a web interface on it. But the third reason I mention is because it actually has three zones of network traffic. It has the red zone, which is connected to the internet. It has a yellow zone, which is connected, an orange zone, which is connected to your demilitarized zone, which is where you put your web servers, and it has an orange zone, which is your internal network. So basically, if you have a network, a machine with three network cards in it, you can actually have an internet zone, an internal protected zone, and the demilitarized zone of which I'm speaking. You can also use this firewall to only have two zones, which is a red zone and a yellow zone, which is your internet and your regular internal network. The only reason they're tagged with colours is because that's something that sighted people can relate to. We could call it the cat zone, the dog zone, and the goldfish zone, if you like. or the NFB, the AFB, and the something else. I mean, it doesn't matter what we call them. They're just the names for the different zones and the different way in which they function. Zero Shell is a live CD. And whilst I wouldn't recommend everybody play with it, if you do have a spare PC or a virtual machine with a couple of NICs in it, it's certainly worth a look, and it's fully controlled using a web interface, which makes a lot of people happy and makes me very sad. But there you have it. Okay, so, there we go, you're on. Whether you're getting audio remains to be seen. Okay, now, is everybody... the other one I'd look at is PFSense, if anybody's interested in firewall distributions, which is pfsense.org, and that one runs under FreeBSD. But the demilitarized zone allows you to put machines into a demilitarized zone, such as a web server, an FTP server, etc., and it allows them to be connectable from the internet. Now, if we have a regular home router, generally configured in the average way, say for example a Linksys WRT310N or something similar, can anybody tell me how many zones do we have? Generally speaking, how many zones?
Two.
Okay, can somebody tell me what they would be?
The internal network and the DMZ.
Not quite. I'll give you the internal network. What do you think the other one would be?
Would it be the internet zone?
That's correct. You're very close. Just not quite there. But so, we have the internal network, which is usually on 192.168.1.x or 10.0.0. whatever, or whatever, and then you've got the external internet, which has got Facebook and YouTube and all that fun stuff on it. Okay? And the router sits between you and the internet. And can anybody tell me what is the procedure that it uses to allow your internal zone to access the internet? It's a three-letter
DMZ.
Acronym. No. We're getting to the DMZ. We haven't got there yet.
ISP.
Kind of. Not quite the answer. I'm saying, what procedure does the router perform to allow all of your internal PCs to access the internet? What's the funky three-letter thing that it does? They're also like little fly buggy things that can bite you if you misspell it. That's a cryptic clue for you all. Anybody know what I'm after? Rhymes with splat. NAT, Network Address Translation. Does anybody remember me talking about this a few lectures back?
I do. I don't know why. I should have caught on, but I didn't. I didn't even realize that's what you were after. Sorry about that, Carrie.
Well, that's all right. That's all right.
I was thinking network access control.
Network access control. Well, that's another one. But no, the one we wanted was network address translation. Remember how the internal network is all 192.168 stuff, which is non-routable, and your external address is whatever your external address happens to be. And you can find out your external address by going to www.whatismyip.com. We'll tell you your external address. And I believe we all did that a few weeks back, or at least most of us did.
Well, mine is 96 dot something, just for information.
And you will notice that you have one external IP address, and you have as many internal addresses as you have computers on your network, unless you are in a corporate setting where you have more than one routable IP. Okay, but the router uses network address translation to hide the PCs on the internal network from the internet, but still allow them connectivity to the internet.
Oh, so that's how come I'm able to access it, I guess, still, even though I have a 192.168.
That is correct. Your router is responsible for making modifications to the packets, and it changes the 192.168 address into what your external internet address is, but it also takes care of handing the packets back from the internet back to your internal PCs so that they can have access to the internet. and you and your roommate or whoever is on your internet connection can both have access to the internet using those 192 addresses. And if you looked at your address and you looked at your roommate's address, for example, you would find that yours was 192.168.1.2 and his was 192.168.1.3 or something like that. The addresses may differ, but you would have internal different IP addresses, and that would be how the router can differentiate between your two computers.
Golly, thank goodness for NAT.
Well, given the global IP shortage, I would definitely say that a lot of people agree with you on that one. And we are running out of IPv4 addresses, but things such as NAT and stuff have stopped us all from having to jump and go to IPv6 yet. I don't know if and when we will ever go to IPv6, but it will have to happen eventually. There are large portions of Japan that are already using IPv6. All right, so we have an external network, which is the internet, and we have an internal network that is your local network. Does anybody remember me talking about the concept of a port, as in a TCP/IP port?
Yeah, it allows stuff to pass through it.
Yes.
Okay, and remember I spoke about services listening on different ports. So if you make a connection to a server on port 80, you're going to get web traffic. If you make a connection to a port on port 143, you're going to get IMAP traffic. If you make a connection to a server on port 53, you're going to do DNS. And we spoke about how each internet service had a different port number.
I have a question about IMAP.
Yeah, you have a question about IMAP? Go ahead.
Do you set it up similar to like setting up POP3? Like, because I have it on my phone and I want to set it up.
Ah, but my question would be, does the mail server that you are going to use support IMAP?
Nope, it doesn't.
Then you're out of luck. Gmail supports IMAP, for example. Yahoo supports IMAP. Fastmail.fm, which has a free email account that you can get, supports IMAP. The free account doesn't allow you to send mail through Fastmail, though. I have to warn you about that. But your target mail server must support IMAP. Otherwise, you cannot use it. Obviously, the advantage with IMAP is that all of the messages live on the mail server, and if you retrieve your messages on your phone and you retrieve your messages on your computer, you will see the same messages. You will not end up with a case where you've got some messages on your phone and some messages on your computer.
Yeah, that was a question I had. Could I set it up if my mail server didn't support it? And if I was able to set it up, is it kind of similar to setting up a POP3 where you just enter the server information and the username and password?
Yeah, pretty much. Sometimes you need to change the ports. For example, Google's IMAP listens on port 995, I think. And sometimes there are some security authentication things that need to be set up. But generally, you just change the... put in the IMAP details into the IMAP tab. And, it functions pretty much like POP3, except your messages are stored on the server.
Okay, that's what I wanted to know.
But saying, can you set it up if the target server doesn't support it, is obviously like saying, going to the store and going, I'd like to buy a chocolate sponge cake, and the store says, I don't have any chocolate sponge cake, and you go, well, I want chocolate sponge cake. So obviously your both ends need to support the same protocol, otherwise you won't get anywhere.
Right.
That example makes me want chocolate sponge cake. Oh, well. Okay, so each thing that you connect outwards to on the internet has a destination port. And you can connect on port 80 for web, 53 for DNS, 119 for NNTP, 143 for IMAP, 110 for POP3, and the list goes on and on. And you can look those up on www.grc.com. Has a good list of ports. That's a Gibson Research Corporation's website. Now, the other thing is each connection also has a source IP, obviously, and a source port. Can anybody tell me why do you think you would have source IPs and source ports and destination IPs and destination ports? Anybody have any idea why we would even do this?
To tell where the the connection originates from and where the connection is going to be at on the other end.
Mm. Anybody else want to add?
Well, sometimes in say, for example, FTP, the ports differ depending on what you're doing. The incoming port usually the destination port on FTP would be 21, and the outgoing port, the source port on FTP would be 20.
Okay. Not quite, and I will demystify FTP in a second, but that's okay. Has it ever occurred to people that if we didn't have a source port, how would we differentiate between more than one connection from a machine running TCP/IP? Let's say you want to open Facebook and YouTube at the same time. How would the computer differentiate between the packets destined that are coming back from Facebook and the connections coming back from YouTube if they both came back on the same source port? That you'd have no way of differentiating which packets belong to which connection. So, what happens is, say, for example, you connect to YouTube and your computer opens a connection from 192.168.1.2 on port 1027, and it connects to YouTube's web server, and you start watching a video about this guy I know, and if you want to look it up, you can search up Blind Man Cooking, and it's where he makes this terrible Chinese meal. And then you go and decide to check what your friends are doing on Facebook. So your computer opens a connection from, say, 192.168.1.2, port 1036, to the Facebook servers. Now, because the source ports differ, the computer can keep track of which connection is which, and you won't get packets confused from Facebook with packets confused from YouTube. Now, the other thing to keep in mind is, and just to demystify the FTP for you, Rich, there's basically two ports that are used for FTP. 21 is what we call the control connection, and that is where you send your commands like bin, and it says, a message comes back saying 200 type set to I, and then you go get space the dot latest dot pirated dot movie dot cam rip dot AVI. And the web server, the FTP server says 150 port command successful. 250 port command successful. 150 opening binary mode connection for my pirated movie camrip.avi. And then what actually happens is that the FTP server connects to you on port 20 and sends the data to you on port 20, unless you're using passive FTP, which I'm not going into here. And port 20 is actually the data connection. So that's why it opens a data connection on port 20, or opens a data connection to the server on port 20, and then it uses the control connection on port 21. So that's what the two ports for FTP are for.
Okay.
Passive FTP works differently, and it actually tells the FTP server what port you're listening on, and then the FTP... Anyway, you can look up passive FTP if that's something that interests you, but you generally have to use passive FTP behind a network address translator, unless, of course, you've got an FTP helper application, which some of the home routers do and some of the home routers don't. Okay, but the point I'm trying to make is that the DMZ is a zone where you put servers and stuff. Now, the reason I'm trying to tell you guys all this stuff is because I just want you guys to write, if you don't have access to the routers, theoretically, what would happen if you performed the steps in Lab 8.4.1 and 8.4.2. Now, when you go into a router and you look down at options and stuff, there's often the ability to do what we call port forwards. Can anybody tell me what a port forward is or might do?
It'll forward the traffic from one port to another, kind of like you're forwarding a phone call.
Yeah, anybody else want to add anything before I demystify?
Yes, it allows for certain things to be passed on through directly to a machine.
That's right. So, for example, if you are running a web server on 192.168.1.5, you can tell the router that you want to port forward on port 80 to be forwarded through to 192.168.1.5. and then you could have, for example, my web server, roxyasocks.dyndns.org, will point to your IP address of your web server, and if people go to my domain, roxyasocks.dyndns.org, it will then connect to the machine inside your network on 192.168.1.5 and serve up any pages that you wish to serve up.
Now, I have a question. I think I asked you this. Will this lab, particular lab, work on my router, Linksys WRT54G?
Yes, it will. But if you, for some reason, do not feel comfortable doing this lab, there are two things you could do. One is you could write it out from a practical perspective and write out what you think should happen. Or the second thing you could do is you could save the configuration file from your router before you perform any modifications, and when you have finished doing this lab, you can restore the configuration to make sure that the router goes back to its configuration that you expect it to have.
And how do I go about saving the configuration and restoring it once I'm done, if I, done it?
Well, you open the router's web interface and you log in with no username and admin as the password is usually the Linksys defaults unless you have changed them, which you should have after doing this class. And you then go into the settings that involve configuration file, and there is an option that says save configuration file. And you hit enter on that, and it says, do you wish to open or save this file? And you hit save, and you save it into a file on your computer hard disk.
How do I restore it?
Well, funnily enough, you go back into the web interface and you log in with the same credentials, and there is a thing that says Restore Configuration, and then there is a Browse button. And you hit the Browse button and you browse to the configuration file on your computer and you hit Upload. Now, interestingly enough, and you will be one of about 4.5 billion people who do this, if you had read the manual to your router, or you had got yourself a hands-on the router manual, it would have told you all of this. But it's okay because nobody reads the documentation anyway. However, if it all fails and goes horribly wrong, may I suggest the user manual?
I'm in the process of purchasing a router so I can do my labs, and I was wondering if the manuals were available in any format other than print.
Yes, they are. They're all PDF files, and the PDF files will read in Acrobat.
Okay, thank you.
And if for any reason you have trouble reading the PDF, and this goes for anybody, we can certainly provide you with a converted copy into a format like .doc or whatever, so that you can read it. Now, I'm not picking on Curtis specifically. I'm talking to you all here. It's important to read the documentation. It really is. And you're all going to go, oh yeah, but I don't have time. I can't be bothered doing that. Who does that anyway? The fact is that if you're dealing with routers that are worth, $3,000 to $5,000 a throw, and you've just pulled them all out of the polystyrene bubble stuff that they come in, and then you end up plugging a cable in one port that it probably shouldn't go in, and the whole thing goes bang, and don't laugh, it's happened, you will find that perhaps reading the book would have been a good idea, or at least skimming the Getting Started section. And one of the things that we've found, for example, one of the things that can make things go bang is if you plug an ISDN phone line into a regular analog phone, the smoke will come out of the regular analog phone. And often you will find that there are actually warnings on the in the terminal adapter manual that will warn you against that stuff before you theoretically do it. Now, one of the things that I cannot stress enough, and we were saying this to one of our other students yesterday, your job as an IT consultant, if you indeed have a job as an IT consultant, a good percentage of your time, probably depends on your job, but 60 to 80% of your time is spent reading and researching and reading and researching and more reading and more researching and learning. And it's very important to know how to access these documents, such as the PDF manuals for, say, a Linksys router, or the manuals for a D-Link router, or the manuals for a Cisco router, or whatever. One of the skills that you should become quite good at as an IT professional is being able to read this documentation and actually utilize it. There are programs that spoil us, like JAWS, that have context-sensitive help. But JAWS also has a series of help files that you can go in and read, and they will tell you lots of interesting things that you otherwise wouldn't have known. And that's also the case for the user guides. I'll put my hand up and say I don't have a chance to read every user guide I come across, but if I'm certainly experiencing any trouble or I'm a bit confused about something, I will pop and open the manual and read as much as I've got time for, and often I learn things that I never would have known unless I'd actually read the user guide. So, there you go.
You're right. When I first got my router set up, I wasn't the one set it up. I didn't know as much as I know now. So, and now she told me it's PDFs out there. I definitely will go look for the links as PDFs and check into it.
Yeah, look, don't get me wrong, Curtis. I don't mind answering your questions, and I have no objection to answering your questions, but it's a case of give a man a fish and all that sort of stuff. And if I can show you how to get access, if I can give you meta access to the information and you can actually get the information yourself, that will also serve you well when you're doing other things. So, but yes, there are actually options in the web interface to save and load the user configuration, and that is how those options work.
Oh, I appreciate it. Yeah, I've definitely... taught me how to fish instead of giving me fish, and that's what I've been doing lately, even with my job I do have, you know, working with an IT company, AT/IT company, so I'm actually learning now.
Well, that's wonderful to hear, and it makes us feel all warm and fuzzy, and that's good, but I am aware that there are certainly challenges to us as blind people getting access to documentation. Some PDFs are more readable than others. May I recommend PDF Converter, which is the princely sum of about $69 if you buy it, which I did. And you basically right-click on any PDF file and go Convert to Word Document. And about 20 seconds later, you have a Word document. And it actually does optical character recognition, so if the PDF is full of images, it will actually OCR the PDF for you. And the OCR engines, because they're in a PDF file, are usually quite good, and the results you get out are quite excellent. Has anybody else used PDF Converter from Nuance?
Yep, it's great.
Yes.
I use it all the time.
Very great.
Yeah, I usually don't try and...
I prefer, like, Open Book for certain things, for a lot of this stuff.
My only issue with Open Book is it's very expensive, and if you can get it, great, but... For those of us that do, I guess for people who just want quick access to stuff.
Exactly. Look, if you have a copy of OpenBook, or you have a copy of Quartz file, or you have a copy of ABBY Fine Reader, or you have these tools at your discretion that are quite expensive, more power to you. I have those tools as well. But my job as somebody who's teaching you guys how to do stuff is to give you options that you might be able to afford and options that you might be able to get your hands on. The other one is Jamal Mazrui's PDF to Text, which is another one that is worth having as well, and it's a freebie. So even if you have these other tools, perhaps having a copy of PDF to Text would be worthwhile. What I used to do in the old days was, before all this technology came out, I actually used to print my PDF into a whole lot of 300 dots per inch TIFF files, and then I would feed the TIFF files into TextBridge, which was the OCR solution I had at the time, and that is how I used to get text out of PDF files before we had the accessibility that we do with our third-party solutions and Acrobat. All right, now to get back to the DMZ, and I apologise, I've gone off on a tangent a bit like that teacher bloke in Yes What, and if you've heard of Yes What, you'll know what I'm talking about, and if you haven't, that's okay. It's an Australian radio show. What the DMZ does is, now we spoke about port forwards. Now if you want information on port forwards, www.portforward.com. I will just type that into the chat, and then I will make sure that website still exists. Unless somebody can check that for me. Portforward.com. If you can check that for me, Scott, or something.
Yeah, hang on. I'm checking it now.
I can check it for you.
Yeah, it works. Works here.
Yeah.
That has got all sorts of information on all different types of routers and how to forward ports and what sort of things you have to do to forward ports. And you'll find that that's also another good resource. So if the manuals let you down, Curtis, which they sometimes do, there's another resource that you can go and look up, and there's all sorts of tutorials and stuff that will tell you how to forward ports on about 300 or 400 different router models. So that's the one where we send all of the people wanting to BitTorrent to, because they need to get their ports forwarded.
All right, I appreciate it.
Okay, now, as we spoke of earlier, a port forward will allow ports from the external internet to connect to the internal network, and you can forward things like web servers, DNS servers, etc. Did anybody know, and a lot of people don't realize this, it's actually written in the Skype help, which I don't think many people read, probably about as many people read the Skype help as many people read those things that come from the local hardware store once they get whatever it is they brought home and try to put it together. If you actually read the... I'm having a really bad day with keeping my train of thought today. I've got other people talking in the background here, which is fine. They're just doing up a diagram picture, but it's a bit rattling. But yeah, if you actually... I just have no idea what the hell I was on about. Oh, well, I have to find something else to talk about.
Skype help.
Skype help, thank you. Thank you. Thanks, guys. If you actually read the Skype help, it actually says that if you look under the connections tab of Skype, there is a listening port that Skype listens on. And usually it's a random port that Skype picks, say, for example, 31804. And if you forward that port through your router to the machine that you are currently on, 31804 or whatever your port is, because yours will be different, and you forward both the TCP and the UDP port, two things will happen. One, Skype will sign in within maybe half a second. And the second thing that will happen is file transfers will be sent directly from you to the destination person without being relayed through a third party. I believe recent versions of Skype can automatically do the port forward for you by using Universal Plug and Play. They never used to, but I think as of version 3.4 or whatever, they will tend to do that. Okay, anybody got any questions on any of the stuff I've covered so far? And is anybody finding any of this useful? Because, I mean, it seems as though it's stuff that I haven't actually covered, so I'm hoping it's kind of useful. But if it's not, I'll, you know, duck off to the cafe and have some Raisin Toast and coffee.
Definitely useful to me.
Okay, now, the DMZ setting on a router. The DMZ setting on a home router, such as the Linksys WRT54G or the Linksys WRT310N or similar, it designates one computer, can I put more underlines and things on that, okay, as a machine where all incoming traffic that is not handled by other port forwards will be sent. So if you've got a port forward on port 80 on your web server and you've got a port forward on 143 for your IMAP server, if you set up a DMZ host, every other port other than 143 and 80 will be forwarded to the DMZ host. Can anybody tell me what a potential problem of doing this might be?
That host might get overloaded with traffic.
Yes, that's one of the other problems. Can anybody think of another problem of forwarding all other ports that are not handled by port forwarding rules to an internal machine on the internal network? What's another problem you might have with doing that?
Hackers. You know, bad stuff can happen. Bad people can get into your machine, that machine.
That's right. If you forward all external traffic to a particular machine, you'd better make sure that machine has either got a software firewall or has hardened security on it so that people do not break into and exploit that machine. Which is why I try and discourage people, generally, from using... Somebody's keyed up. There we are. Generally from using a DMZ, unless there is no other way to allow the port forwards to happen. However, you do get to use the DMZ for a short period of time during this lab, and then you turn it back off again. Okay. So given that information, I think people should be able to attempt lab 8.4.1 and 8.4.2. I will be going through those labs and looking at them, but you should be able to write them down from a theoretical perspective. We would like you to have routers that you can use to access these. However, the actual procedure for setting up the access to the routers we have here is far more involved than I think you guys want to be getting involved with in Discovery 1. So if you can write it from a theoretical perspective, that would be just fine. The other thing I would recommend is for people to look up terms such as DMZ on whatis.com. And to look up things like a DMZ as far as networking is concerned on Wikipedia and stuff, so that they can find out what these terms mean, and then that should allow you to answer the questions that are asked in those two labs. Now, does anybody have any other questions on anything they want me to cover, anything they want me to go over, anything they want me to talk about? Has anybody got any questions about the procedure for taking the final and all that sort of thing? Does everybody know what they have to do when that's going to happen?
Sign up in the group when y'all let us know that it's one, and then get on Ventrilo with you guys and take it.
Well, generally speaking, you basically notify us as to when you would like to do the final. There is an 8-hour activation window, and one of us will try and make ourselves available on Ventrilo whilst you are doing the final, so that if you have any questions or whatever, that you can do that, and you have a maximum of 3 hours to do the final. And I believe the final is worth approximately 40% of your mark. We are going to re-weight the marks in the next course because we think the labs should be worth more than 15%. We want to put them up at about 30, I think. Okay.
You have to get a 75% on the final to pass it.
Yes, and you get 2 shots at the final. That's 2 shots at the final. However, be aware that if things really do go bad and there is genuine reasons why you do not pass the final, we can do things to help you out. Now, I think I'm just about to see if there's a practice final for Discovery. I'll be with you guys in a second, but we can activate the practice final for you guys. Yes, I think there is a practice final. So what I'd like you guys to do is let me know when you feel you guys are comfortable to take the practice final. And I think we can put the practice final up for a week or so, and anybody who wants to take it. The practice final does not affect your mark. I cannot stress that enough.
Hey, I'll take a shot at it.
Well, make sure you've done all of the exams for Module 1 through 9 before you think of attempting the practice final, however.
I found the diagram descriptions for the practice final as well. I see they're up there.
They are. So if you want some idea of what is it going to be in an exam, and you don't get very much of an idea, you can go and look at the diagram descriptions, and then you'll have some idea as to what sort of things we might be asking you about. Although it won't give you a very good idea, but it's better than nothing at all. Okay, anybody got anything else they want covered? I'm just seeing if there is the assessment here that I can activate here. Yep, there is the practice final exam, and I can activate that for a week, so I'll do that once I've finished with the lecture. The other thing that you all need to complete, and I will post this to the announce list, you all must complete course feedback, or we cannot graduate you. It doesn't matter how well you did in everything else. If you do not do the course feedback, we cannot graduate you. Even if you just open the feedback and then go down to the bottom and go submit my feedback, if you can't be bothered answering all the questions, although we'd like if you could answer the questions, that would be good. All right, guys, unless anybody's got anything else, and unless anybody emails me, and it's in your advantages to email me, this is the last revision lecture. So if you guys want me to talk about anything else next week, get in touch with me before next week, email Cavi Instructors, and we will cover whatever it is you want next week before you sit the final, whenever you choose to do that, because we are finished the official lectures for this year.